I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of an accident on the interstate that led to an unexpected lesson in life and death. Callie Lovett was in heavy traffic when she was forced to swerve to avoid a dog on the highway. She wound up losing control of her car, crossing the median, and crashing into an oncoming vehicle. The driver of that car was badly hurt and died some days later in hospital. Callie says she expected to be vilified by the man's family, but instead they reached out to her. They welcomed her into the hospital when the man was in critical condition. They invited her to his funeral. They made it clear that they did not blame her for his death. And that act of forgiveness, says Callie, was the beginning of a turnaround for her. Prior to the accident, she says, she'd been drifting, but shortly afterwards she started thinking about what she wanted to do with her own life. She went back to school, and she'll be here after the news to talk about her own moment of transformation. There is something statistically numbing about the way that traffic accidents are reported over the holidays. I guess it makes sense to report that X number of people died in such and such a winter storm when so many people were on the road, but the statistics tend to surface once, maybe twice on the radio, and then disappear. The point I'm making is that that kind of reporting makes us forget that behind every such accident are people whose lives are quite literally thrust together. Callie Lovett was behind the wheel when she hit another car with a husband and wife inside.
My actions had caused this to occur. So I went to her directly and sat down beside her and asked her if she was his wife, and she nodded yes. And I asked her how he was, and she said not good. And she started to cry, and I said that I was driving the other car.
Callie Lovett looks back on an accident that changed her life in ways she never would have expected. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Callie Lovett was on North Carolina's I-40 on a Friday afternoon. There's a wide, grassy median that separates the traffic. It was busy, late in the day. Callie was with her mother and driving her mother's car on their way to a wedding. She's not entirely sure what happened. All she remembers was seeing a dog come round the car in front of her.
It seemed to me that the car in front of me had hit the dog. And it was a large lab-type dog. And it was airborne when I saw it initially. And my first thought was that it was going to hit my windshield and that I was going to cause a major car pileup. I knew that there were lots of cars behind me. And so I swerved to the left to try and miss the dog. And the dog sort of drifted in the air to the left. And so I swerved again. And when I cut the wheel the second time, I lost control of the car and went across the median. And the median never felt like any sort of bump. It was like glass. It was like we were airborne.
It was grass, right, that you were driving?
It was grass. There was no guardrail of any kind.
And how fast were you going, Callie?
Later, when they measured the skid marks, they said I was going 65. So I may have been going a little over 70.
How wide is the median?
At least two lanes wide.
So as you're crossing the median, you're still going forward at this point.
Correct.
Can you see where you're going to enter the oncoming traffic?
Yes, yes. And I was actually sort of counting cars coming in the direction to see where we were going to hit and how many we were going to hit. And it turns out I was off a little bit, and I thought that I would miss his car and I would instead hit the ones behind him. And when we did hit, after that I couldn't see anything anymore. We were spinning, and I kept waiting for the next hit. I kept waiting for another car. I assumed there would be multiple cars, and that never came. And finally we were sitting still on the shoulder of the road.
How were you?
I was fine. I had sprained my shoulder and I had hit my head pretty hard, but I was fine.
And your mother, what was she like?
My mother had broken her arm, and she knew immediately. She told me immediately that she'd broken her arm. And she had also hit her head hard enough to cut it. And so she was bleeding. And she was really out of it. The very first thing she said to me when the car stopped was, "You should have just hit the dog." And then after that, as soon as the car stopped moving, there were already people who had pulled over and gotten out of their cars and who were running toward us.
I've been in a car accident, nothing quite as dramatic as this, but this is the point at which time starts to lose its, you know, I remember this and then I remember this. I don't know if it was the same for you. But
that's about right. I mean, from when the car stopped and when she said, "You should have hit the dog," from then sort of until we went to the hospital, things are in patches. At some point when I got out of the car, and was sitting on the shoulder and was talking to someone who had come to help and asked her if she would go see how the folks in the other car were. And she went over there and she came back to me and she said that the driver was able to get out of the car. I guess they had been concerned, EMS had been concerned they were going to have to cut him out of the car, and that he was able to get out through the window. But she didn't tell me much more than that. I think she knew that he was badly injured, and she didn't really tell me much more than that.
And did you all then have to go to the hospital?
Yes, and his wife was in the car with him as well. There were two people in that car, and then the two of us in our car. And so we all four were taken, I believe, in all separate ambulances to the hospital.
And at this point, are you able to keep track of what's going on with the pair of people who were in the car that you hit?
I didn't know at that point what was going on. I was sort of asking. And
could you hear anything? Do you remember anything?
After they finished with the x-rays and the CAT scan, I was sitting in the hallway and I could hear him yelling in pain. I could hear the driver yelling. And I knew that's who it was. There was hardly anyone in the hospital. I knew that's who it was.
How were you feeling at that point? I mean, were you feeling in any way like you were the author of this accident? I mean, you'd swerved to avoid a dog. Were you thinking that this was your fault anyway?
I know later I absolutely felt that way. I don't know if I felt that way at that moment or not, or if I felt like it was something that had happened to me as well. I think I felt sort of outside of my body. I think I felt so detached and shocked by what was going on. And I do remember thinking that, you know, one minute you're on the way to a wedding and the next minute you're sitting in the emergency room, and how odd life is and how you just can't, you don't have any idea of what's happening. You think you're in control and you're walking down the street and you have plans for tomorrow and, you know.
Guess what? You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As Callie Lovett waited in the hospital, wondering what had happened to the people in the other car, the state trooper who'd been at the scene came up to her.
He told me, don't you know you should never swerve? Don't you know you should have hit the dog? Don't you realize what you've done? He was very arrogant and condescending and irritating.
Why? I mean, why would he pick on you like that?
I think it was because I think he thought that I was a stupid kid. My hair was sort of magenta at the time, and I had body piercings, and I think that he saw me as a stupid kid, and he thought I just didn't know any better and I deserved it.
Not exactly the sort of thing you need at that moment, though, right?
No. I couldn't believe that there was someone who was seriously, seriously injured, and he was lecturing me about hitting the dog. It was stunning to me.
At this point, was he saying, Callie, it was your fault, or, and you know, you could be charged, or you could be
no.
in trouble, or nothing like that, right?
Nobody ever said that to me. Nobody ever said, you can be charged for this, or there will be further repercussions.
Yeah,
at
yeah.
that time, nobody said anything like that to me.
What happened next?
So before we left the hospital that night, I went to the front desk and I asked them for his name, and they wrote it down on a piece of paper for me. And I stayed at my mother's house, and the next day I went to the intensive care unit.
What did you know about this guy at this point?
I knew that he was Hmong. That was the only thing I knew, from Laos, part of the Hmong tribe.
Right.
I had asked one of the orderlies or nurses in the hospital about him, and he had said he's Hmong. And I didn't know what that meant at the time. I didn't know much about the history of the Hmong people. So that was all that I knew.
Did he speak English? Did his wife speak English?
His wife spoke very, very little English, but he had a large extended family, and other people that were around did speak English. When I went to the ICU, there were probably 20 family members there.
This is at the hospital in Winston-Salem.
Right.
Did that surprise you to see so many people there?
Oh, that was pretty shocking, walking into the intensive care unit.
Well, were you still bandaged up in any way?
I had a sling on my arm. That was all, really.
And so you walk into the hospital, and are you thinking that they will know that you were the other person in the accident? What are you thinking?
No, I knew they wouldn't know immediately who I was. I knew I would have to tell them who I was. My mother didn't want me to go.
To the hospital?
To the hospital. She felt like it would be somehow admitting guilt, that we might end up being sued, that it somehow might come back around. And I told her that I had to go, that I didn't have a choice. And I didn't feel like I had a choice. Later, people would say to me, you know, oh, I couldn't have done that. And I think you don't know what you can do until you have to do it.
Did you go by yourself?
I went with my uncle, who is a minister, who is used to being in difficult situations, and I asked him to come with me.
And he was okay with this? He knew why you wanted to go?
Yes, yeah. He knew why. And I do believe that walking into the waiting room was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. It was very, very difficult. And I was prepared for them to react in any way they wanted to react.
Were you thinking that they were going to blame you then, Callie?
Yes, I thought they'd blame me.
Did you blame yourself at that time?
Yes. I knew that it was truly an accident. I hadn't been driving recklessly or drinking or doing anything irresponsible. I had tried to make the best decision I could. At the same time, my actions had caused this to occur.
And did you know how badly hurt the man was at that time? I mean, how much did you know about his condition?
I think I knew that his pelvis was broken. And I think I knew that he had internal damage. I knew that it was very serious, and I knew that it was life-threatening. But I didn't know how life-threatening.
So take me back to the waiting room. You said it was the hardest thing.
Well, I really was willing for them to react in any way they wanted to react. I was prepared for them to spit on me, to yell at me, to react in any way. And I was willing to take that. And it turned out that I had seen his wife in the emergency room the night before in Morganton. I didn't realize that I had seen her, but when I walked into the waiting room, I recognized her. So I went to her directly and sat down beside her and asked her if she was his wife, and she nodded yes. And I asked her how he was, and she said, not good. And she started to cry, and I said that I was driving the other car. And at that point, the woman who was sitting on the other side of her sort of heard me say that and sat up, and she had a baby on her lap. She handed off the baby and turned, and she said, you were driving the other car. And she spoke perfect English. And it turns out that she was her sister. She was the wife's sister. They hugged me immediately. They told me how sorry they were. They didn't ask me what happened. Not until I was leaving that day did they even ask me what happened.
Callie Levitt wasn't to know it at the time, but these acts of kindness from the wife and the sister-in-law of Pao Yang, the man who'd been so badly hurt in the accident, would start Callie's life on a new path. And I'll talk with her about how that happened in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. These first few days of every new year are, for many of us, a time of resolve, a time to see if we can change our lives in ways that the start of a new year always invites. For Callie Levitt, change was not a matter of choice. It was a car accident. Callie was 26. She'd been driving her mom on a major highway when she lost control of her car and swerved into a head-on collision. The accident put the driver of the other car in the hospital in critical condition. He was a 45-year-old Hmong from Laos who'd come to the U.S. after the Vietnam War with his young wife. His name was Pao Yang. Callie Levitt had met his wife and sister-in-law in the hallway of the hospital.
His wife asked if I would go and see him, and I said yes, I would. And so she and the sister and my uncle and I went into the ICU unit. The wife sort of tended to him and wiped his face and stroked him. And, you know, he was hooked up to a lot of machines.
Was he conscious? Was he relating to his wife? No.
No. Before we left, we were there probably just 5 minutes or so in the ICU unit, and my uncle asked if they would like to pray, and they said yes, and we said a prayer there in the ICU unit, and then we went back into the waiting room, and that's when the sister asked me what happened. And I told her about the dog then, that I had swerved to miss the dog. But she had never even asked me until then what happened.
And there was no one there who was looking at you with an accusing eye or...
No, not at all.
How did that make you feel?
Well, relieved. Relieved that they didn't hate me. grateful, I think. Very grateful that they were as empathetic as they were. And I wanted them so much to know how I felt and how sorry I was that this had happened. And I was afraid if they were angry that I wouldn't be able to tell them that. They wouldn't allow me to tell them that. And so I was very grateful that they allowed me to tell them.
Did you go back to the hospital?
I did. I went back a couple more times within the next week. I brought them food once, and several of them were spending the night there in the waiting room. So at one point, I brought some blankets over for them. I learned a lot about his history. He had four children. The oldest one was not that much younger than I. And I met all four of the children, and his children, his youngest son didn't much want to have anything to do with me. His youngest son was 14, I believe. He made it pretty clear he didn't want to talk to me. But the other children were very pleasant. And then when he died, his oldest daughter called me, and she said that her mother had asked her to call to tell me when the funeral was and where the funeral was to be sure that I knew in case I wanted to come.
This was some days later?
He died 11 days after the accident. He lived for 11 days in the ICU.
So you got an invitation to the funeral. What did you think?
There was no question about whether I was going. I mean, if they had invited me, I was going to go. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people there.
Is Morganton a place where a lot of Hmong people have moved?
Apparently, that is the case. I did not know that before. So hundreds of people, extended family. Right when I walked into the foyer, his wife saw me and came over and hugged me, and she was carrying around a large framed picture of him that she showed me. And a couple other times she showed me photos of him. Whenever she'd see me, she would take out photos and show me photos of him. And in the funeral itself, it was definitely not like any funeral I've experienced before. It wasn't really a service being performed. The casket was up at the front and it was open. And people were sort of standing around, and they would stand by the casket as long as they felt like, and then they would sit down. And then if they felt like going back up again, they'd go up again. And everyone was sobbing openly and showing externally a lot of grief. And they were also stroking the body a lot, touching him. And they had put this huge family-sized pack of paper napkins up by the head of the casket so that anyone who needed tissues had that available.
Were there many other white people there? Were you?
My mother and I were the only ones. It was very clear who we were. My mother still had her cast on. I don't remember if I was wearing my sling at that time or not.
But were you self-conscious? Was your mother self-conscious?
My mother was incredibly self-conscious. I was not self-conscious. I knew this is what I was supposed to be doing, and it was where I was supposed to be, and I wanted to honor him and to honor the family and to be there for that and to express those feelings. My mother, she didn't know how to deal with it. And she was very, very anxious and self-conscious and kept saying that we should go. She kept feeling like we were intruding. And she kept saying, you know, we've shown up. We've done what we need to do. We need to leave them alone.
I understand what she's thinking. I mean, I understand that sense of this is not our place, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And she... At one point, they did have a sort of semi-ceremony where everyone sat down and somebody stood up and said a few words.
All in Hmong, right?
All in Hmong. And there was a niece that was sitting in front of us who turned around and introduced herself, and then she would translate for us. And she chatted with my mother a little bit and I think helped make my mother feel a little more relaxed. But then after that, they gave a few more minutes for people to go up to the casket if they wanted to. And then they were going to start lining up for the procession. And my mother at that point said, we really need to go. We need to go. And I said, you don't think we should go to the burial? And she said, no, that's inappropriate. Only close family goes to the burial. We need to go. And so I said, okay, we'll go. So we went out and we got in the car. And as we were driving away, I was getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And I knew that we should have gone to the burial. I just felt strongly that we should have gone. And that I so didn't want for them to think that I was trying to just show up
and
to make an appearance. And I wanted to do
as painful as it was, as awkward as it was, whatever it was that I needed to do. So we went back, we parked, and everyone was in the parking lot already in their cars lining up. And the niece who had been sitting in front of us was in a car right near us, and she waved me over. And I said to her, "Do you think that we should go to the burial? Is it appropriate for us to go?" And she said, "Yes, yes, you should go."
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm talking with Callie Lovett. She was behind the wheel of a car that killed 45-year-old Pao Yang. It turned out that Callie was expected by the family to go to his burial. Pao Yang had been a tribal leader. Hundreds of people were there. When Callie thinks back to that time now, she considers it kind of a moment of transformation for her. She'd been drifting, partying way too much. She also had hair dyed purple and numerous piercings on her body.
I think for the first time, really, I felt uncomfortable with the color of my hair because I didn't want them to just see the external. I didn't want for them just to see that and stop there. I really wanted to be exposed to them for my true self. I wanted my true self to be exposed to them.
But your true self was not necessarily the colored hair and the body piercing. This was a part of an exterior that you had at the time? I don't want to go
one
too deep on this,
argue
but you know
that,
what I'm saying, right?
Well, one could certainly argue that it's an expression of an internal self, and I think that I would have argued that.
At the time.
At the time. But at that moment, standing out there at the funeral, and I can remember thinking that while we were standing at the burial, that I wished that I didn't have that on. I wished that my hair were my natural color. I wished that I looked very plain so that they could see inside and be exposed to them for my true self. I wanted my true self to be exposed to them.
So the burial lasted how long?
A long time.
Did you stay till the end?
We did stay till the end. My mother started in again, of course, of we should go. We've you know, made our appearance. We've done what we need to do. And by then I'd gotten it together and I just said, "You need to be quiet. We're staying. We're staying till the end. We're staying until they leave." And she kept saying it and I kept saying, "You need to be quiet." And then also one of the cousins said to my mother, "Your daughter has a good heart." And that...
They said that at the burial?
Yes. And that was what I wanted them to see behind the hair and the piercings.
Callie Lovett had also decided that the state trooper who talked to her at the scene of the car accident and later in the hospital had it in for her because of how she looked. He told her at the time of the accident that he thought she'd been driving recklessly.
3 months later, the police called me at work and told me that I was being charged with vehicular manslaughter. It was a criminal charge being brought by the state. It was not a civil charge brought by the family. And they actually sent a car to pick me up at work and take me downtown.
What do you remember of the trial itself?
They subpoenaed his wife, and she completely fell apart on the stand and had to sort of be carried away.
There must have been a part of you at that point, Callie, thinking that that really wasn't very necessary.
I was really angry that the trial occurred at all, and I was particularly angry that they had subpoenaed her there for that and made her go through this again. I mean, it had been 6 months now since he had died, and it was just so unnecessary.
So what kind of a case, though, did they have against you? What could they say?
The argument of the state trooper when he was on the stand was that I was driving recklessly. That's when my lawyer brought up the skid marks and how fast I was going. And, of course, they said I was going 65 miles an hour, which was the speed limit. So my lawyer is asking, so how was she driving recklessly? And the argument was that since I was driving a nice car, my mother had a nice car, that the reason I had swerved to miss the dog was because I didn't want to mess up my nice car.
What happened?
The judge found me not guilty immediately. And afterwards, you know, immediately after the judge found me not guilty, I got up and went over to his wife and hugged her again. And apparently the judge stood and watched before he left the courtroom. He watched for a while. And the state trooper, of course, came over to tell me he was so sorry things had turned out this way. But I looked nice by then, you know. I no longer looked like a stupid kid.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Callie Lovett had kind of put her life on hold, not looking for work, not making any long-term decisions about what to do until this trial on her charge of reckless driving was over.
the next day after the trial, when I woke up, I didn't have anything to do. I literally, it was the oddest sensation. I literally didn't have anything to do, and I didn't know. I just sat on my couch, and I thought, well, what do I do now? Do I go to the grocery? And I called some friends up, and I said, can I come hang out with you? And they said yes. So I went over there, and we decided to go to a movie, and we picked some random movie. And it turned out the opening scene of the movie was an incredibly, incredibly violent scene where someone is accidentally killed. And it was way too much for me to handle. So I got up and left the film, and I went outside to my car, and I knew I was going to cry. And I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and cry, and I'll sob a little bit, and I'll get it out, and we'll get it over with. So I started to cry, and then I couldn't stop. And I couldn't stop, and I couldn't stop. And I was waiting for it to pass so I could drive, and it didn't stop. And I must have sat there for 30, 45 minutes and cried.
What kind of crying was this, Callie? Was it the sort of racking sobs?
Oh, yes.
Like, you shouldn't have been driving.
Yes, racking sobs. But it turns out I cried like that for about 6 days, maybe a full week, nonstop. And I would eat while I cried, and I would take showers while I cried. And at one point, I do remember thinking, I'm never going to stop. Like, they're going to have to put me away, and I'm going to cry for the rest of my life. And I felt completely out of control. It was the strangest sensation. And I remember my mother on the phone saying, why are you crying? And I said, I'm just so sad. And she said, you know it wasn't your fault. People kept saying this to me. You know it wasn't your fault. But it was my fault. I mean, I know what they mean. I know what they mean. I know that they meant that I didn't intentionally do anything. But I knew that it was my fault. I knew that I had caused this. If I had made a different decision, if I had done something different at that moment, the outcome might have been different.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Callie Lovett's telling us how her role in a car accident changed her. Before the crash that took a man's life, she was saying she'd been more interested in partying than much of anything else. But then she says it all changed.
It was slow. The change was slow, but I just couldn't be a part of that as much anymore. And I sort of stopped hanging out with a lot of those people, sort of one by one.
Those kinds of changes that you're talking about, did you connect those with the accident and your feelings surrounding that accident, or was this just a sort of coincidental growing up time for you?
No, I knew that it was connected to the accident. I talked about it a lot. I knew that it had a huge impact on me. I knew that, you know, in the crowd I was hanging out with, there was a lot of drama. There was a lot of depression and a lot of drama, and I just no longer had the patience for it. I just felt like, you know, there are so many larger issues. There are so many, I mean, these things just are so unimportant.
You looked at it as kind of self-indulgent?
Yes, that's exactly right. I looked at it as very self-indulgent, and I just didn't have the patience. I just didn't, you know, if you want to make a change in your life, make a change, but don't whine about it.
It's been almost 10 years, right?
Mm.
And when you look back on it now, Callie, was it seeing the change in the life of Mr. Powell's family that focused you on that, or was it seeing the change in your own life, right? Because two families' lives were dramatically changed by that. Of course, the death of the man is a bigger change, and I'm not trying to make a parallel here, but when you look back on it now with that, with the sort of benefit of hindsight and the opportunity to have thought about it, what do you think?
Well, the short answer is I think it's my life, the change in my life that really affected me. But, you know, one thing that's interesting about this is the fact that they were Hmong and that they had experienced so much loss on an individual and a cultural level.
To get out of Laos, to get to be refugees, to leave all that behind them, is that what you mean?
Yes, because they were refugees, because something like, you know, 60% of their entire population had been lost in the war. It was so amazing to me that they could have endured that and to come to America and then have this happen. I don't know. And I tend to think that was one of the reasons that they were not more hateful to me, that they were able to have the kind of empathy that they did, because they were able to see that I was also a victim in this. You know, they didn't have the same sort of entitlement that I think a lot of American families would have had in their response to me.
So their response, their openness to you, their willingness or eagerness to hug you whenever, that was what was new to you.
That was a lot of it. I didn't expect that. When I first went to the ICU unit, I don't think I ever entertained that they would respond that way.
I know, but it kept on, Callie. They hugged you at the funeral. They hugged you at the burial. They hugged you at the trial. I hadn't thought about that until you sort of reflected on what they'd been through. But in many ways, it was their reaction to the accident. Not the accident, it was their reaction to the accident that changed you.
I believe that's right. The fact that the cousin said, you know, your daughter has a good heart, that they were able to see past their own pain. They were able to acknowledge that I was hurting as well. I mean, it's sort of amazing and selfless.
Well, it makes you wonder if I would have that same generosity, right?
Yeah, it was, they were very, very generous of spirit. They were amazing to me.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Callie Lovett contacted us with her story. You can do the same thing. Think of it as your own resolution for this new year. Go on. You've been thinking about getting in touch with us anyway, telling us that story. Take a chance. Our website is thestory.org. You can find a button there to contact me. Coming up in just a moment, a story of love and a resolution kept. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I was talking earlier with Callie Lovett about how she turned a tragic car accident into a time of transformation. My next guest shares a similar kind of resolve, turning loss into gain. When Madeline McBroom decided this past summer to cycle up one of the toughest peaks in the Alps, she just went ahead and did it. But this story of Madeline's determination starts back when she was all of 19 years old. She'd fallen in love with an older man. Charles was 20 years her senior. And so although Madeline entered this romance cautiously, still her friends and family warned her, "This is trouble. He'll die before you do. Be very careful." Well, they were right, but so was Madeline. She had 35 years with her husband, Charles, and absolutely no regrets.
Best thing I ever did in my life, I would do it over again.
Why do you say that?
If you laid out on a table pieces of a puzzle, and I represented half of the pieces and my husband represented the other half, I was the settled one. I was the mature one. I was the one that brought structure to his life. He was so fun-loving, high-spirited, just a visionary and exciting person, but he needed structure. He needed somebody to believe in him and to be there for him.
And when you were 25, he'd be 45, right?
Right.
When you were 35, he was 55. In those years that you had together, Madeline, did you live with this kind of dread that the simple math of age would mean that he would likely die before you?
I didn't live with the dread. I lived with an awareness that I should not take him for granted. There was not a day that when he would leave the house or come home that I did not go to him to hug him or kiss him. He was special every single minute. So instead of the dread, I knew that I was going to end up alone if you just do the math. But what it gave me, which was a much richer marriage.
And then he had a heart attack when? About 5-6 years ago, is that right?
He had a brief heart episode in his late 30s.
Right.
He had heart surgery in 1990. He had the severe heart attack that debilitated him in 2001.
2001, right. Mm-hmm. And that was a turning point for you because at that time the nature of your relationship changed, right?
Oh, yes.
Tell me how you think of that change today.
He was quieter. He did not have the energy to laugh or smile the way that he did before. He was very, very sweet, accepting of his fate, positive attitude, but just very different. He couldn't hear well as his hearing was declining. He didn't have the energy. So to finish some of the business he had going, I had to step forward.
Was this about the time that you got hooked on watching cycling?
I got hooked on cycling about 2003. This is when Lance Armstrong had such a hard time winning that particular year, 2003.
2003 was a tough one for him?
Very tough.
Okay.
And I said, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. I said, how did he win those other ones? And that coincided with the fact that I was at home, and three-quarters of the time I was alone with my husband. I did have help, but we lived alone. It was just the two of us. So there were a lot of times late at night when I did what I had to do to get him to bed. I would be so awake that in order to go to sleep, I had to do something to relax myself. So I would put on the CDs and tapes of previous years of the Tour de France races, and I became somewhat of an expert.
Was there a similarity in your own life and watching what those cyclists were going through? I mean, your days were long, you were worn out at the end, and you could sort of pop in a disc and watch these guys grinding it up a hill. Did you feel a certain sympathy for them?
Oh, absolutely. I have been an athlete all my life. Being an athlete, I could see what they were going through. And then when I started riding, I certainly understood it a lot more.
Yeah, so, when did it become real for you? When did you stop being a fan and start cycling yourself?
I guess it was 2005 and started riding out of... it was 2004 because it was before my husband died
right. That
I started riding. And I did that because hospice started coming in, and I had volunteers that would allow me to go off for an hour or so and ride.
Now, hospice help would come in, and some people would go to a movie. Other people would go and sit in a park and just be by themselves. What was it that attracted you, though, about getting out on the bike yourself?
Getting outside and not having to listen, to be free to just fly through the wind, and knowing that he was safe, somebody was there with him. But it was the combination of being outside and the exercise and what exercise does for me in coping.
So I see two parallel tracks here. There's the Madeleine who's watching the Tour de France, and the Madeleine who's out cycling through the neighborhoods of different towns in North Carolina. But at what point did you start to think, hey, I should go over to France. I should cycle somewhere where those guys are riding. I mean, that's the nastiest piece of riding that exists anywhere on the planet.
There were several things that made me want to do that. My mother had moved in with me 4 or 5 months after my husband died. She was not in the situation that my husband was. She was functional and she was okay, but she was clearly declining. I didn't know what to do with my grief. So the way I deal with grief is to have something that gives me a goal to push myself harder physically. So when I was laying out this trip, and I planned the trip last fall, I was going to be on a 15-day trip with some people all the way around France, and we were going to end up in Nice. And I said, you know, Nice is not that far from Grenoble, and I could go over to Alpe d'Huez, and I could ride it. I said, now, if I can't ride it up, I can at least walk up it and push the bike.
You've never seen the mountain itself. You've
no.
never been there. So part of it was just to go to this one piece of cycling history that you'd seen on videotape and wanted to see in person, right?
The Mecca of cycling. The announcers say, this is the altar of cycling. This is the Mecca of cycling. Everyone wants to see Alpe d'Huez. And he was right. And then I saw an interview of Sheryl Crow, and she said...
This is Lance Armstrong's wife.
No, his girlfriend, and they have
girlfriend?
Since split up.
Yeah,
but
okay.
She rode up it. And I thought, okay, I am older than she is, but if she can ride up it, it's doable by me. And I started doing research on the internet to try to figure out how I was going to make it happen. And I tried groups to start with, and I was turned away and said, no, you would not be. It's too hard. It will take you too long to ride with our group. So I said, well, I'm going to have to figure something else out.
Why were they discouraging? Did they not like the fact that, what, were you 50 at this time? How old were you?
54.
54 years old? Okay.
It was the fact that they are set up to help avid cyclists. And I knew I couldn't ride it. Lance Armstrong rode it at around 38 minutes.
Right.
An avid cyclist could probably ride it between an hour and a half, depending on their level. I knew that I was not going to be able to probably ride it at that speed because I'd never ridden a mountain.
Wait a second. You'd never ridden a mountain?
I had never ridden a mountain. Now, see, the reason
Madeline, could you not just start out in a few hills in the Blue Ridge Mountains before you go to France?
I always do things like that. Like the only 18 round of golf I've ever done was at Pinehurst. I haven't played since, but it was awesome. So people say, that's the only golf you've ever played? Yes. So I kind of do these kind of things, but it was important to be there, and it was important to have what was kind of an outrageous goal to make myself push harder. And I turned myself into somewhat of a 12-hour-a-day thinking about how can I increase my exercise level and work a full-time job. So I came up with strategies.
But did you do a lot more training? Did you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you were in shape by the time you got
there. I was pushing myself hard. Oh, yes.
Now, did you take your own bike over to France?
No. Now, that's a problem. I did not take my bike, and I did not take my clip-in bike shoes and pedals, which if you don't know about those, gives you 15% more power to be able to clip your shoes into your pedals.
Because you're actually lifting the pedal with your at the same time.
So I got on the internet, and I got Grenoble Cycling Forum. And they said, cycling-friendly bed and breakfast. And they listed a couple of them. So I started emailing them and asking questions. And I said, this is my profile. I'm 54 years old. I'm a good athlete. I do ride now, but I've never ridden a mountain. Can I do Alpe d'Huez successfully? And the fellow responded back, as long as you're not in a hurry, you certainly can. He says, we're on Switchback 12, which is halfway up the mountain. He said, so you can stop.
If you've really had it at that point, you've got a bed waiting for you right there.
Right. So that was, I thought that was a good compromise.
All right. I'm going to leave aside the fact that you had rented a bike to do Alpe d'Huez, because I know cyclists who would think that if they didn't have their own bicycle, there's just no, they wouldn't even get on it. So put me inside your head, sitting on the bike at the bottom of the mountain. What are you thinking?
Well, I was so exhilarated the morning that we woke up because the sun was shining, and you could see your breath, so I knew that it was going to be perfect temperature to ride. So the bed and breakfast, they took me down to get the bike, and of course I was getting pretty excited at this point, and butterflies. And after I leave the bike shop, it was so funny. I had gotten turned around, and I thought, I don't know which way it is to Alpe d'Huez. It wasn't far, but there were mountains all around. And I thought, this is so ridiculous. Here I am alone in France, and I thought my husband would be just rolling his eyes at this. And he says, my hard-headed wife. But I took a deep breath, and I said, well, this is it. So I just started riding toward the mountain.
You know, listening to you describe being on the mountain makes me think that this was a real moment of just genuine excitement, thrill for you after years of caring for your husband in the latter years of his life, then taking care of your mom as she came home to die with you. At this point, there's a kind of about just getting out in the open air. Is that going through your mind at the same time?
Oh, absolutely. It was the first time I had been really happy and excited about something in years. I mean, it was joy just overtook me. And it was not just from, it was the journey up the mountain.
All right, now we only got you to the second switchback on this. And I think you said there's 12, is that right?
21.
21, okay.
And it starts at 1. Okay. No, I'm sorry, it starts at the 21, and number 1 is at the top.
All right. So how did it go?
Amazingly, there were women older than me, which gave me hope. There were people riding on tandem bikes, two at a time. There were men skiing up it on roller skates,
those inline skates with the poles that they use?
Yes. Yeah. They were skiing up it. There were a lot of overweight men that did not speak English that would just smile at me.
Maybe they were beyond speech at that point.
but you could tell that it was something that they really wanted.
So how long did it take you to get to the top?
Well, if you count the entire time, 2 hours and 45 minutes, but that wasn't cycling time. Now, I was a great believer in stopping and looking at along the way. Reaching the summit, I knew, was probably not going to be, other than personally satisfying because I achieved a goal, it was the journey up the mountain that I was interested in.
2 hours and 45 minutes, finally at the top. What went through your mind?
Well, before we get to the top, let me tell you what I did halfway up at Switchback 12, where my bed and breakfast was. Men can go to the restroom on the side of the mountain. Women cannot, not too easily, especially when they're guarding a bike. So I took my bike up to the bed and breakfast, and I had to climb stairs carrying the bike. You know, I had ridden halfway up the mountain, went in, ate some strawberries, went to the restroom, had some water, and said, okay, how do you feel? I was more excited than ever. So I flew out of there and rode several of the switchbacks without stopping after I had stopped for a while. But to answer your question about getting to the top, I knew from the tapes that when I rode into Alpe d'Huez, even though it said you've arrived, I knew that was not the end where they finished the stage, although a lot of bicyclists thought so. Mm-hmm. But because I had watched so many tapes, I knew I had to go further. I knew that there was supposed to be a sharp turn. The buildings did not look right. So I kept riding. And so I finally made it all the way to the top, and there was only one gentleman there, and he was running a caterpillar, digging, you know, out the side of a road or something.
Right.
So I rode around in circle. I had ran out of water at that point. There was no one around, although I didn't feel afraid. You know, it was just a thrill to be standing where I knew the race ended.
Madeleine McBroom went to the French Alps this summer to cycle up one of the most difficult parts of the Tour de France course, Alpe d'Huez. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. And so there's Madeleine at the top of the mountain. It was, she says, a little odd to be there, virtually alone, and nothing to mark the summit.
That was disappointing. There was not a plaque there. And, you know, I thought, there, I can't go any further. This has got to be it. So I was disappointed that it didn't say you've arrived and had some kind of brochure or something. But I was still very happy to have made it.
Yeah, what were you thinking of? Was this about you and your husband, you and your mother? Was this about you? What was it?
Well, you know, when I got back, the husband-mother moment had more to do. I thought about that, and I thought they would both be smiling because they both believed in me, and they always were challenging me, and they were... But when I got back to the bed and breakfast after my descent, which was thrilling, I wasn't certain that I was going to ride down it. I really thought I'd be too tired. And I'm not into speed, but I was looking at the scenery, and I'd come to the turn, and I would go, oh my God, I got to turn. I got to hit the brakes. But it was so exciting. But when I looked in the mirror, I looked at the mirror and looked at myself. I said, all right, Mac, and all right, Mother, I did it, and I did it for you. So that was the moment that came together. Thinking about them and, you know, really stopping and having the emotion. At the top, I was out of water. I was a little bit nervous about there was no one around. I thought, you know, don't push your luck. The wind was blowing so hard, I had to get off my bike and put my wind jacket on. And I had to push my bike a little bit there until I could get the wind at my back.
So when you looked in the mirror, how did your hair look?
Well, you talking about before or after?
No,
I took
I'm thinking
the helmet
of you
off.
Looking in the mirror with the after you finished the ride all the way up and then halfway down.
I'm beyond the stage of caring what I look like. You can't cycle and care what you look like in the sweat and you know. So it was absolutely. And now I've just got to think of what's next.
Yeah, that's the part that I was trying to think of. And when you do that, how does it change you?
Oh, it changes you a lot. When I came back from France, I had a lot of trouble focusing. I knew that I was going to have to change my life. I read something recently in Washington Post, and it says there are times in your life where you have to make frightening changes or else die a slow death. And I said, that's what I'm doing. If I don't make a change, I'm going to die a slow death. And I had, in the last week or two, I've had that conversation with my manager. I've reached 25 years of service with my company. It's been a fabulous ride. But I also have realized that it's time for me to go.
So this wasn't really the end of a chapter as much as it is the beginning of a new one for you?
Right. Right. It was proving to myself that I'm not too old to take on outrageous adventures or challenges, and that will just open the door to an array of things that I've been thinking about.
That's Madeline McBroom. She wrote in with her story of her outrageous adventure. And you can do the same thing. Just send us a couple of lines to our website. It's easy to find us at thestory.org. Just look for the button, send in a story. Or you can call and leave a message on our toll-free line at 1-888-966-9862. Now, if you know of a good story and a person too bashful to write in, well, tell us anyway. We'll take care of the pleading and the convincing. We're very good at that. Trust me. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.